MacCast, Tuesday, August 7th, 2018. Hey, MacGeeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for MacGeeks by MacGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Hope you are having a great day, a great week, hopefully a great month. We're all the way into August already. It feels like the year is coming to an end rather quickly, but that's actually pretty good news for Apple and Mac fans, because in the fall, we're going to get a bunch of new stuff. I just don't know how I'm going to pay for it all. That's what I got to figure out between now and then. And of course, in this episode, we're going to be talking a lot about what those new items are going to be. We're also going to get a little deeper into some of the Mac numbers from the last quarterly results call. We're going to talk about Apple Pay. It is gaining some success, and we'll get into the details of that. Apple ends an affiliate program, and that makes some of their supporters a little bit cranky. And also leaks and some HomePod stuff, and we'll talk about Apple hitting a huge financial milestone this week. And that's going to wrap up the news. And then we're going to get into some GarageBand stuff. I have a really cool, probably one of the coolest Apple support call stories that I have ever had to share with you. We're going to do a little interview with a friend of mine named Tanner, and we're going to talk about Siri, a little follow-up on some of our Siri discussion based on some feedback that I received from the community. And then I have an awesome thing of the moment. We're going to talk about podcast app that I recently discovered, and also actually a couple of podcast apps. There's a little bonus in there. So if you're looking for a new podcast app, stay tuned for all of that. And that will round out the show for this week. I'm not going to waste too much time jumping into the show, but I do have one little bit of housekeeping that I need to get to. I need to give a big congratulations to Nick from the UK, who won the episode 666 backmasking Easter egg challenge. Yep, he caught on to the clues that I had in the last episode of the MacCast, which was our 666th episode. So I thought I'd do something kind of fun and do a little reverse audio message in there, a la the Beatles and the Revolver album. A bunch of clues in there. If you looked at the chapter for that section, it was titled Revolver, and he figured out all the clues. He reversed the audio in that section and discovered a hidden message that I had left for you all. He was actually the first person to do it. Surprisingly, only four people so far have reversed the audio to figure out that Easter egg, but it was basically a message saying that if you were the first person to email me an email with the subject line, Paul is dead, you would be the winner of a prize. And so Paul is receiving a $20 1Password gift card that can be used whether he is already a subscriber to 1Password or if he'd like to subscribe to 1Password. You get $20 credit toward your purchase. So Paul, that is already, or Nick rather, that is already in the mail. It's off to you there in the UK, and I hope you enjoy that. And thanks for figuring that out. And for those of you who missed it, go back. You can reverse that audio. And if you don't know how to do that, stay tuned toward the end of the episode, and I will explain exactly how you do that with GarageBand. All right, let's jump into the news. I want to dive into some of the quarterly results call numbers again from last week. Apple posted huge profits. They did very, very well in the third quarter of 2018. But one area of disappointment, I guess, is the best way you can put that was the Mac numbers in terms of Mac unit sales and even Mac profits. The community is now kind of looking at that, trying to ponder and wonder why those Mac numbers were down. I think we talked in the last episode about one of the obvious points, but they're trying to figure out why and what does it mean. You know, does this spell doom for Apple? Is the Mac going to be a problem moving forward? Is it the slow and steady decline of the Mac? It's starting to feel like the 90s again, right? A little bit, maybe just a little bit. And so I thought we'd dive into that a little bit. Most of the folks analyzing the stuff, myself included, looking at the why, point to the lack of new Mac models this year, over the last couple years, actually. There really hasn't been a lot exciting going on with the Mac. Of course, we got the iMac Pro, which is really, really cool, and I think that helped a little bit. And more recently, we got those new MacBook Pros, the 2018 updates, but those kind of came late in the quarter, and so they really couldn't give much of an impact to these quarterly numbers that Apple just reported. But it might not be as simple as just lack of new Mac models. Another possible contributing factor would be, of course, people supplementing their computer needs with other devices, most specifically if you're an Apple fan, an iPhone or an iPad. And I think there's a lot of that going on. We've been seeing that happen for several years now, and I think overall, you know, Macs themselves have always been on this kind of long upgrade cycle for most of Apple's customers. I think Mac owners, Apple owners, tend to keep their laptops and their desktops a little bit longer than our PC Windows-using counterparts, and so Apple's always had to deal with that, but now that people are moving some of their computing needs onto, say, an iPad or an iPhone, I think that's extended even further. So typically 2 to 3 years was the upgrade cycle, I think, for a lot of Apple fans. I think that's been extended out to more like 4 or 5 years. And I hear from some of you in the community that even say, oh, I don't even upgrade for 6 or 7 years. And that is becoming a problem for Apple in terms of Mac sales numbers, right? The Mac is just slowing down in terms of how frequently people upgrade. And that means when Apple posts their numbers, they're not seeing as many sales. Now, to remind you of what those numbers were, the last quarter, Apple sold 3.72 million Macs. And Apple had not sold fewer than 4 million Macs in a quarter since 2013. And that number, 3.72 million Macs for a single quarter, was the lowest number of Macs sold in a quarter since the third quarter of 2010. So Apple had a great run. It was actually a 13% year-over-year drop. So kind of the second half of that equation, second half of this analysis is, okay, we know they're slowing. We know kind of some of the reasons and indicators why, maybe not all of them, but how bad is that? You know, is this a problem for Apple? And it turns out it probably isn't such a big issue, because the machines that Apple did update, specifically the iMac Pro and the MacBook Pros, they do have a higher average selling price. They sell for more. Apple makes a little bit more profit on those. So even though they sold fewer Macs, that higher profit means the revenue was only down about 5%. So 13% down on unit sales, 5% down on revenue. And remember, that's in a quarter when we really didn't have that many new machines for consumers to go in and buy. So you got a lot of people in a waiting, holding pattern. You also have back to school coming up. A lot of people buy new machines, especially for their kids and for students and stuff like that, as they go into the new school season. So I do expect that to pick up a little bit. Apple is also expected, again, at the same time, to update the bulk of its Mac lineup this fall. So we should see a turnaround in those Mac unit numbers. But I think overall, it's important to remember that Mac sales, they tend to be about 4 to 5 million a quarter. We might see that slide a little bit more toward the upper threes and fours per quarter, just because of all these other factors. So, you know, it's something that's happening. Apple's bulk of their revenue is coming from other sources that aren't the Mac anymore. And all that says to me is it's just a sign that Apple is a diverse company. It's changed. You know, this doesn't surprise anybody, any of us in the Mac community who've been in the Apple and Mac community over the past decade. We know this has been a change. But it also doesn't mean that Apple is abandoning the Mac and that the Mac isn't a big important part of their business. Apple has reiterated over and over again that they do care about the Mac. It is part of their business, and they will continue to develop and support it. I think we just have to come to the understanding that it's probably not going to be as frequently anymore. And I think that's probably the right thing for Apple to do. I think a Mac update cycle of every 18 to 24 months on most models is good. I think the problem for a lot of us and the complaint right now is Apple has extended that out even longer, especially if you look at things like, oh, I don't know, the Mac Mini, which is a much beloved machine in our community. I hear from so many of you. I love the Mac Mini personally. I think it is going to get some update love this quarter. But again, that's going to be one of those machines that's kind of, it's Apple's entry-level model. It's the one that Apple uses to woo over switchers. And maybe it doesn't have to be updated as frequently. But it'd be nice if it was every, you know, 3 years instead of going on, what's it now been, 4 or 5 years since we saw an update. And many will argue that the 2014 update really wasn't an update. So, you know, Mac numbers were low last quarter, but the summary of all this is I don't think we have to be too concerned about it. Apple Pay is looking like it's turning out to be pretty successful for Apple, especially when you put it up against some of the other mobile payment platforms that are out there. As a matter of fact, Apple Pay transactions have actually tripled since March of 2017, and Tim Cook mentioned in that Q3 results call that Apple processed 1 billion transactions, 1 billion Apple Pay transactions last quarter. And that's good for Apple's revenue because they get a little bit of a cut of that, but also just good for Apple Pay as a payment platform in general. Jupiter Research actually predicts that Apple Pay will account for 1 in 2 mobile device payments by 2020. So they're expecting Apple Pay to have about 50% of the mobile device payment market by 2020. And that is surprising because you've got other competitors out there like Samsung Pay and Google Pay and several other independent ones, especially specialized ones that service like China. So that's really good news. And this week we heard an announcement on the Apple Pay front that Chase Bank here in the U.S. rolled out Apple Pay to 16,000 of its ATMs. So if you're a Chase customer, you can now go to the ATM and you don't have to have your ATM card with you. You can actually use your Apple Pay wallet and your cards that are registered to your wallet to withdraw money. And that's Chase following other banks in the U.S. like Wells Fargo and B of A for doing that. And I know if you're an international MacCast listener out there, you're going, geez, what's wrong with you guys? You guys are kind of behind the times. We've had this contactless stuff and this mobile payment stuff for years. Yep, we are a little bit, but being an Apple fan, I'm super excited that Apple Pay is kind of gaining this kind of momentum. And I've personally, you've heard me on this podcast sort of question it because I go to many retailers and they'll say, nope, we don't take Apple Pay yet. We did get the news that, you know, CVS was adding Apple Pay and 7-Eleven was adding Apple Pay support. So it's expanding. It's getting better. And as far as the experience goes, it's looking like consumers and also publications like Consumer Reports are finding the experience of Apple Pay is really, really good and maybe overall a little bit better than some of the competitors. Consumer Reports did its first head-to-head testing of peer-to-peer mobile payment services, and they declared Apple Pay the best of the bunch. The report tested Venmo, Square Cash, Facebook Messenger, and Apple Pay. Now, to be fair, they didn't look at Google's payment platform, nor did they look at Samsung Pay. I think Google wasn't looked at because it's relatively new in terms of how they rolled it out for peer-to-peer. Again, this is not the contactless at the register. This is, you know, sending cash through messages from one person to another, that sort of thing. And they noted that all of the platforms were very good to use, easy to use, but that Apple Pay Cash had the slight edge, mainly because of the security and privacy aspects. Apple is not tapping into your privacy when you're doing those transactions. Those are kept between you and the other person, and Apple doesn't want to know anything about them. They're not shared with retailers or any other services. And specifically, Apple Pay was the only one to limit that customer information that was being gathered, and it was not being shared along with the payment information. So they kept that private, kept it away from the banks and the processors and stuff like that, where the other services don't necessarily do that. It also didn't store credit card numbers, and Apple, of course, promises never to sell your data or information off to anyone. So that gave it the edge in this test, although it did lose points because it only works on Apple's platform. It only works with Apple devices and only more recent devices, as many of you probably know. So they took a little bit hit there, but Apple coming out on top, at least as far as Consumer Reports is concerned, as the best peer-to-peer payment platform that you can use. And this is all good news for those of us who are Apple Pay fans, because it means that the more people that are touting the sort of success of Apple Pay, the more retailers and more banks and more companies are going to want to support the platform. So I think that's great. Again, I'm a huge Apple Pay fan, as you know, and I hear the same from many of you. Apple is ending one of its affiliate programs, and a few publishers out there are not too happy about it. Apple emailed publishers to let them know that it's winding down its affiliate program for Mac and iOS apps, as well as for in-app purchases. They are going to continue to keep the program that they have in place for other iTunes content like music, movies, books, and TV shows. The apps are going to be phased out of the affiliate program starting on October 1st, and the news did cause a small outcry from some publishers who actually rely on the app affiliate links for a significant part of the revenue stream to support their content and their websites and blogs and things like that. As a matter of fact, Apple's program was quite nice. For those of you who don't know how affiliate programs work, you sign up, you register with the affiliate program, and then you add a little bit of code to links to Apple's App Store or iTunes Store that you would have on your website. And then if a person follows that link, actually makes a purchase, the affiliate gets a little bit of referral revenue. So Apple actually gives them a payment. And Apple's program, the payout was pretty good. It came out of Apple's 30% revenue cut from the apps. So you go buy an app, say it's $10. You know, Apple is going to get their $3. And then if that was an affiliate link, one of your affiliate links, Apple was going to give you 7% out of that $3. So 7% of the $3 for the affiliates on app purchases. And then if it's an in-app purchase that was made off of an affiliate link, then you would get 2.5% of that revenue. The in-app purchase rate was also at 7%, but Apple dropped that down to 2.5% last year. They had also talked about dropping the purchased app rate down to 2.5%, but backtracked on that after there was a bunch of outrage from publishers in the community. So that does make me wonder if they had not made such a beef about Apple lowering the rate on the affiliate rate on app purchases, would Apple be discontinuing the program now? I think they probably still would. Apple says the program just isn't as necessary anymore because the whole point behind it was to drive sales of apps and to help app developers out, not necessarily to help publishers earn a living or make money off of the links. And Apple says the redesigned app stores and iOS stores have now increased the methods for app discovery, and folks are able to find those apps without the need for the third-party affiliate links. So you can see how if you're running a website where you are giving Apple a lot and apps on the App Store a lot of editorial sort of buzz and juice, and that's driving traffic to Apple's site to make sales, and Apple's saying these things, that would upset you a little bit. I do have to admit the editorial nature of the new app stores for me, especially with the Today section, does seem to replace some of the blogs and publications that I used to go to online to kind of find that content. I'm enjoying the editorial content that Apple publishes. I'm enjoying seeing sort of the apps that they focus on and recommend recommend. Their team over there is doing a very good job. It is definitely not the only place that I get that information from, and there are great websites out there. As a matter of fact, one of the news publications who says they're going to be particularly hard hit by this and may even have to close down is Touch Arcade. They've been very vocal since this announcement about the potential impact of the decision on their publication. And I do think it would be a shame because they are a great website. So I'm hoping they can find another way to figure out revenue-wise how to support their website. They do a great job with reviewing mobile games over there. And I can see how this would impact them. But at the flip side of it, I also do have to figure that publications, any publication or any sort of content creator who is putting all their eggs in one basket when it comes to generating revenue to support the thing that they're doing, that's tough to do. I've been through it being a podcaster. Just having advertising as the only revenue source honestly doesn't work out. There needs to be other kinds of ways to support the podcast, which is why we have the MacCast Patreon and direct support and a few other things. So, we're always looking into ways to diversify the support so that if any one revenue source slows us down or goes away, we're still able to keep doing podcasts. And I think if you're running a blog or a website, anybody producing content and relying on that for your support, you need to branch out. And, otherwise stuff like this happens. Apple on a whim decides to shut down your main or only source of revenue and you're stuck. So I think Touch Arcade and some of those others will be able to figure it out. There's lots of revenue opportunities outside of Apple's affiliate programs. But again, Apple's affiliate programs were a nice one, and I can see where some of these people are coming from in terms of this. But I don't know. What do you think? Is this a huge deal? Are you a content creator that relies on Apple's affiliate program? Shoot us an email. Let me know what you're thinking about this. MacCast@gmail.com. iOS 12 betas keep coming out. They're coming out fast and furious. Of course, we're getting ready for iPhone and iPad updates in the fall. That's expected to be when Apple will also update iOS 11 to iOS 12. And every time a new beta comes out, of course, people are always looking for hints and clues about what the hardware might look like. And this time around, a few folks dug into the resources and they found some icons that seem to indicate and basically confirm what we're thinking about the new iPads. These new iOS 11 icons show small bezels, rounded corners, and no buttons. And the icon was found in the battery usage user interface. There is, interestingly, no notch, though, on that icon. Icons tend to get simplified, so take this with a grain of salt. But it looks like if the icon is accurate, the TrueDepth camera might be located in the top bezel of that new redesigned iPad. So there might be no notch. We had been thinking there would be a notch. And just for comparison, the iPhone X icon does have the notch in it. So it does seem to confirm that that might be the overall look and design. Doing some further digging, Guillerme Rambo, a famous Apple leaker and now writer for 9to5 Mac, also uncovered some image assets that would suggest that there are rounded corners in the new iPad design, just like the updated iPhone X design or the iPhone X design. He also found some icons for the iPhone in the iOS Passkit UI Foundation. These would be icons related to Passkit, and that icon seems to depict the new larger iPhone X Plus size with the notch, but that icon confirming that we are going to get a plus size version of the iPhone X. I don't think anybody thought that wasn't going to happen, but again, we're getting to the point now where things are solidifying and we're starting to get a lot of confirmation on a lot of our earlier rumors, and that's what's happening right now with our hardware leaks at this point. On the iPhone front, additional suggestions are coming from the Economic Daily News that the dual SIM iPhone that we've been talking about and that is being rumored might actually just be a variant of the 6.8 1-inch LCD model, and it would be a version that would be sold exclusively in China. So that would potentially be bad news for other international customers outside the Chinese market. There is a suggestion that Apple also might call the LCD iPhone the iPhone 9, although I'm not putting much stake in that rumor. I personally am vying for them simply calling it the iPhone and then having the iPhone 10 and the iPhone 10 Plus be the 5.8 inch and 6.5 inch updated models that we get this year. On the dual SIM thing, we had had past rumors that had suggested a dual SIM model and that the dual SIM model would be that 6.5 inch iPhone 10 Plus. This rumor obviously contradicts that. It would make sense for a dual SIM variant to be in the Chinese market, and I get why it would be, especially for that market, the lower cost or lower priced 6.1 inch LCD model. I have a feeling that maybe these could be two separate rumors that are both true, that we might get a dual SIM in the larger phone for Apple's premium higher end customers, and we also might get a dual SIM version at the lower price point that is exclusive to China, because that market is very price sensitive. And it's my understanding a lot of people in China tend to have dual carriers or want dual carriers. And the whole idea behind a dual SIM iPhone is you can have two carriers in different regions or different parts of the country or different parts of the world, and you're not having to swap SIMs in and out. You can just go between those networks without any hassle. And so a lot of people are looking forward to having some dual SIM options finally in some versions of the iPhone. So I do think that it'll happen. A few other things related to iPhones and the latest leaks. There is reports now that Apple might not include a 3.5 millimeter to Lightning headphone adapter along with this year's iPhones. Apple has been including that since they got rid of the 3.5 millimeter headphone jack in their iPhone designs. I buy that. I think it's time. I think we've had a number of years without the headphone jack, and now if you need an adapter, you're going to have to shell out the cash for it. Apple's not going to give it to you in the box. And I think they sell for about $10, if I'm remembering the price point right. So not that big a deal. And frankly, I don't even use mine. I think I have it somewhere. I don't even know where it is because I haven't used it in so long. I think it's in the case that I keep with my MacBook Pro. I have all my dongles and things in a little like grid kind of case. That was actually a $10 special from Target. But it's been really, really handy to have, and that's where I keep all my stuff, and I think it's in there, but I don't think anybody's going to cry over the missing headphone adapter. I know a lot of people who accidentally even threw it out, not even realizing it was in there. So something that's likely going to happen and a rumor we heard about this week. And then finally, iPhone-wise, TSMC, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, Apple's manufacturer of some of their A-series processors, was hit this week by a, what they're calling, quote, debilitating computer virus. It actually shut down their factories, which has never happened before. The extent of the infiltration, they claimed, varied based on a factory-by-factory basis, but it did cause them to shut down. At first, they didn't say what the attack specifically was, just that they had an attack, but they did state that it was not the work of a network intrusion, so it didn't come kind of from an outside source targeting them. Later in a statement, they confirmed that what they were hit by was a variant of the 2017 WannaCry ransom virus, and that it was an unidentified vendor that provided the company with the infected tool. So it came from an outside vendor, but it wasn't a malicious attack on their factories. By Monday, they were back up and running at 80% capacity. Monday of this week as we record the podcast. So this is the week of August 7th. And they had already begun commercial production of chips for Apple, the A12 chips, presumably, and they're being manufactured on their advanced 7-nanometer process. So there would likely be a slight impact to those yields, but Reuters reports that the impact should be relatively limited, and that's because the supply chain is usually prepared for these kinds of incidents. They ramp up, they overproduce in the early days, so that if there is a problem in terms of quality control or some incident like this, something happens with a factory, maybe a fire, a line has to shut down, they've actually already kind of accounted for that. So they have that in place, and they were surprisingly able to recover relatively quickly from this. So I don't expect that we're going to hear about delayed iPhones because of this specific incident. Of course, as we get closer, we will always hear about iPhone delays and Apple possibly missing ship dates through supply chain issues and things like that. But as it always usually turns out, Apple comes out fine. So I wouldn't worry about it too much, and this shouldn't have too big an impact. Consumer Intelligence Research Partners says in a new report that Apple's HomePod has a, quote, small but meaningful market share of the U.S. speaker market. They estimate that Apple sold about 3 million HomePods so far, and the HomePod has increased its market share more recently, up to 6% in the second quarter of 2018. That's the quarter ending on June 30th. Previous to that, they had had about 3% market share. To put that all into perspective, though, Amazon has about 70% of the smart speaker market and Google Home about 24%. So Apple has a very small fraction. But the reason it is meaningful, as the report notes, is that Apple is grabbing some of that market share away from their competitors, and that the HomePod does have that higher selling point. So they're selling at the higher end of the market, meaning that revenue-wise, every time they sell a smart speaker, they are actually making quite a bit more profit than some of their competitors. Although they do also note that that higher price point is limiting Apple's ability to, they say, compete in the space, but I guess that depends on your term of competition. If your sole rationale behind that is how much market share, how many units are they selling, then yes, it's going to limit their ability to compete on a pure unit sales level. But in terms of success of the product, customer satisfaction, profits, I think that's a little bit different story. But there are still these rumors that Apple is considering a lower cost version of the HomePod, somewhere in the mid-range between $100 and $200 US. And I think that's likely going to happen. I think Apple is going to have that, if for nothing more than to give existing HomePod customers an option for maybe some satellite speakers. I don't think I have a need for or would buy a second $329 HomePod, although I have considered it. But if Apple were to come out with something that was in the $150, $200 range that offered similar performance and quality and I could add in other areas of my home, yeah, that might be something that I jump on. I'm still very glad, though, that I bought my current HomePod. I love it. I use it every day. I think it is absolutely fabulous. I think it is, again, like the AirPods, one of the better products Apple has put out on the market over the recent years. And anybody I talk to who has a HomePod reiterates that to me. Occasionally I hear someone who says, you know, I tried it out, it wasn't for me, I like my Sonos better, or I like my Amazon Echoes better. And that's great. What I found in many, many cases is that those folks are people who are more invested in the Amazon or Google ecosystem and less in the Apple ecosystem, and are also more interested in the product for purely the smart home, smart speaker features. And they're not in that area wholly invested in HomeKit. I've said this before on the MacCast, though, I think the HomePod is the perfect device if you're fully invested in Apple's ecosystem. That would include Apple Music and HomeKit. I think there's no better smart speaker product that you could get if that's the environment that you're operating in. And Apple, you know, their numbers seem to be growing. So I think the HomePod, it's off to a slow start, but I think it's going to climb up there and be a very successful product. You have to remember, too, things like the iPad and even the iPhone kind of had a slow start before they really took on and really gained a lot of market share, and it did take Apple diversifying those products, the iPod as well, before that really happened. So I think we will see Apple diversify the HomePod line over the years, and I think that's going to do nothing other than improve their market share and their profits. And speaking of profits, last thing in the news for this week, although we probably buried the lead a little bit, depending upon your perspective, Apple is now the first $1 trillion company. Woo! You know, fireworks, confetti, whatever you want. Apple's stock price did close high enough last week to earn it the honor of becoming the first company ever to have a market cap over $1 trillion. Now, what does that mean? Well, that number is calculated by the share price times the total number of shares that exist in the market, and you reach this market cap number. For Apple, that magic number was $207.05 per share, and it can go above or below that, and that, of course, adjusts the market cap. So there's no guarantee that Apple's going to stay there at this moment, but right now, as we record this podcast, I didn't check it today, but yesterday when I was doing the show notes, it was definitely above that number. So they still had their $1 trillion market cap. But it is really debatable whether or not this number really means anything beyond just being a really cool milestone. I mean, it's cool considering, in my opinion, the many predictions, especially back in the mid-90s, that Apple was doomed and they were going to go out of business and they were no longer going to be a company. There was no way they could survive. Remember Michael Dell saying that Apple should sell off all the shares and give the money back to, or sell off the company and give the profits to the shareholders, or the earnings from the sale to the shareholders. Stuff like that. You know, Wired Magazine had its Prey cover. Business Week did a story about it, although in really cool form this week. They tweeted a version of that cover along with the Apple $1 trillion story, sort of poking fun at themselves and saying, yep, we kind of got this wrong. Tim Cook, his thoughts on it, I think, are pertinent and really do have the right perspective, and the perspective that we should all have about this number. You know, some people went crazy about this, thinking it was like a really, really big deal. It is a big deal, but in the right perspective. And Tim Cook called it a, quote, significant milestone. Again, it's a milestone. And he also said that the achievement is the result of Apple's focus on innovation, putting their products and customers first, and always staying true to their values. Basically, the work that Apple does and the products that are created from that work and that passion, those drive the profits and the success, and that's how they got to this number. It wasn't the other way around. It wasn't about focusing on how do we become the first $1 trillion company, how do we just get the profits and things we need to, you know, hit these stock milestone or these investor milestones. That's not how Apple runs the business, and that's not how they got there. And I think that's the important part, right? Apple is successful and people are buying the stock because they innovate, they make really great products, they consistently drive the business toward profitability, and those are the things that have made them successful. So good job, Apple, for being the first $1 trillion company. I'm sure others are going to follow. I think Amazon's not far behind them. But it was kind of cool that this happened this week, and we do need to give them a little bit of credit for that. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Jamf Now. Jamf Now makes it easy to set up, manage, and protect your Apple devices. You know, it's pretty easy to keep track of your own Mac, your iPad, your iPhone, but what about the other Apple devices, especially if you run a business or you're in a work environment? As that business is growing, so does your digital inventory. You're buying assets for employees, iPads, Macs, iPhones. That is growing, and it makes it exponentially harder to manage everybody's devices, control what's on there, make sure security is being maintained. And that's especially true if you have remote employees. A lot of companies these days, you don't even have a centralized company. You have employees at remote locations, maybe working from home, and you want to be able to manage their devices as well. Well, with Jamf now, you can check your digital inventory, you can distribute your Wi-Fi and email settings, you can deploy apps, you can protect your company's data, you can even lock and wipe a device as needed from anywhere. Jamf now manages your devices so you can focus on your business, and there is no IT experience needed. They make it super, super easy. So if you run any kind of operation where you're dealing with multiple devices, a multi-device management solution is really a must. And so you should take a moment and check out Jamf now. They make it super easy for you to get started because you can manage up to 3 devices for free for forever. So you can try it out. There's going to be no cost to you. It's specifically designed for teams and small businesses, and they make it really, really easy to get going. So MacCast listeners, you can start securing your business today, setting up your first 3 devices for free, and you can add more devices for just $2 a month per device. Create your free account today at jamf.com/MacCast. That's jamf.com/MACCAST to get started with Jamf now. And a big, big thank you to them for their support of the show. All right, I told you at the beginning of the episode, we had that little hidden backmasked bit of audio. Basically, backmasking is just reversing the audio. And in there was a little clue where if you deciphered it, you could win a prize. But you may or may not know or have known, how, Adam, do I actually reverse that audio? So I thought I'd just cover that as a little tip for you. It's actually pretty easy, and you have the software that you need built right into your Mac, and that is GarageBand. So if you open up GarageBand and create a new project, just a new blank project, you can import any audio file simply by dragging it right into your timeline. I think that's the easiest way, although you can also, of course, browse and import it if you'd like. That'll put it on its own track. And then when you go into that track, you need to select the region, or you could do the entire track if you want, but select the region that you want to reverse out. And the easiest way to do that is to split out the section to create a region in the timeline. The way you do that is you place the playhead in GarageBand at the start of the region that you want to clip, and you go under the edit menu and you choose split regions at playhead. That's going to split that track right at that point. You can also use the keyboard shortcut command T. I actually do this all the time when I'm editing the podcast, by the way. I'm constantly splitting tracks, adjusting, fixing audio, fixing little errors that I make. Yeah, I make errors as I record the stuff, splitting those out, recombining it back together. And split region at playhead is a handy little command inside GarageBand. So split it at the start of the region that you want to reverse the audio on, and then go to the end of the region, the end point or the out point. I guess the technical terms are in points and out points, right? End of that region, same thing, split the region at the playhead at that point, and now you have that little section. Select that new region, because that's the thing that we're going to want to reverse, and then with that region selected in the editor, which is at the bottom left, in the bottom left of your window down there, you'll see a little tab that says regions. If you don't see that, go under the view menu and choose show editor, and that will put you into the editor mode. And then you can click on the region tab, and then inside the region tab, there is simply a little checkbox that says reverse playback. And if you hit that checkbox, it will reverse the playback of that region. And there you go, you have a little bit of reversed audio. Now, I know there's third-party apps and tools out there that can also do this, but I wanted to cover this tip in terms of how you do it with GarageBand. If you do know a simpler way, or what you feel is a better way to reverse a bit of audio on your Mac or even on your iOS device, and you want to recommend it to us, send me an email. Shoot me an audio comment, even better, in a couple minutes. Just explain the app that you use and how you do it, and we'll share that on a future episode of MacCast. So you can shoot those audio comments or those emails to maccast@gmail.com. But that's how you reverse audio using GarageBand. All right, this next thing is pretty cool, I have to tell you. I received a tweet from a friend of mine who was going through some trouble with his iPhone. He was having some issues. He was having some trouble getting it resolved. He was working with Apple on something, and then everything went kind of completely south, and he had to take some deeper action to kind of deal with it. Good news is the end of this is a pretty happy story. I think anybody who is an Apple or a Mac fan would be excited to be this guy, and he tweeted me about what happened to him. And I wanted to get him on the line and talk to him about it because it really is an amazing story. Probably one of the most amazing Apple support stories that I personally have ever heard. So his name is Tanner. He's a friend of mine. We actually met at Nerdtacular a couple years ago. And here is what happened with his iPhone and how it turned out. Hey, Tanner, how's it going?
I'm pretty good, Adam. How about yourself?
I am good, although... You know, I'm hearing rumors through the grapevine, our friend Barry, and then I think you also reached out to me on Twitter, that a week or so ago you weren't doing so fine, at least not when it came to your Mac. You want to, like, kind of mention what was going on, and then we'll maybe talk about, I guess, a recommendation that you got, and then the results. So what was happening with your Mac?
Yeah, so it was my iPhone 10.
Sorry.
And yeah, no problem. My iPhone 10 was having some screen touch issues. So I was getting like 100 inputs a second on my phone. So it was essentially not usable. Luckily, I had purchased AppleCare Plus.
So it was stuck on? Like it was like thinking that somebody was touching it constantly kind of thing?
I could shut it, like put it in sleep. But anytime I would open it up, it would just start touching apps and opening things and changing settings. So
it's like the digitizer got like...
Yeah, the digitizer went out.
Okay, mm-hmm. Cool.
And luckily I had AppleCare Plus, so scheduled the Genie Spa appointment, went over down to the Apple Store. They took a look at it. Well, so I live in Arizona, but unfortunately we do get freak rainstorms sometimes, and the SIM card tray wasn't inserted all the way, mm-hmm. and it tripped the liquid detector in there.
So
they're like, no problem. We have a replacement device right here for you. So the guy goes in the back, brings out a brand new iPhone 10 to just do a swap, and then he plugs my old iPhone into his diagnostic computer and starts running stuff. And he's like, oh, that's weird. It's saying that we need to ship it out. I'm like, oh, really? For what? Said, well, I don't know. Sometimes they want to take a look on the inside, but, you know, we should get you a new phone really soon. In fact, let me go talk to my manager and see if we can override this.
Right.
So the manager comes over and is like, nope, we can't do it. You're going to have to go without a phone. Here's an iPhone 6 if you want one. I'm like, no, that's fine. I have my own device back at home. I don't want to, like, lose or break yours.
Right.
And so anyway, I leave the store. I said, how long is this going to take? Because I leave out of the country in like 4 days. And they said, well, we can have it back to you by then. I'm like, okay, cool. So I take out my SIM card and I go home and swap it. And then they end up shipping it out to their depot or wherever it goes to get fixed.
Yeah, I believe it's down in Texas, but yeah.
Yeah, I think so. Anyway, so then the next day I check the repair status and it's still not showing that it's gotten to the depot. I know, oh, that's kind of weird. Usually they're pretty quick about that. So I contacted Apple and I said, hey, what's going on? They said, well, we've seemed to misplaced your shipment. I said, what do you mean misplaced my shipment? And they're like, yeah, it just hasn't shown up yet. I said, okay, so what are we going to do about this? Is there anything we can do? Well, just give it 2 to 3 weeks, and if it doesn't show up, we'll send you a new phone. I'm like, two to three weeks? I'm like, no, that's not going to happen. And then, so I'm getting frustrated. So I give it another day, contact them, same thing. No one can do anything.
They don't know where the phone is. So basically, it got lost in shipping.
Right. Okay. In their terms, it wasn't that, but yes. And so I escalate it up and up as far as I can go, you know, just with the 1-800 AppleCare support number.
Right.
And I'm getting the same answer. We can't do anything. There's nothing to do. So a friend, Barry, I sent him a text. I'm like, look, this is what's going on. What do you recommend? Because they're really good about this stuff.
Right.
And they're like, well, just keep escalating it. Or you could email Tim Cook. I'm like, oh, okay. You know, so I open up my Mac and I draft up this email basically saying I choose Apple for the quality of the product and I choose Apple for the quality of the customer service that you don't get, you know, really anywhere else.
Right.
And I've never had an issue. It wasn't a
T Cook at Apple.com, right?
That's right. T Cook at Apple.com. And, so I draft up this email just being very honest and open and not, you know, ranting and raving, being rude, that kind of thing. Anyway, so I hit send, and I think I also CC'd on there the VP of AppleCare. I forget their name, but I included them.
Okay.
And I didn't think anything of it after that. I said, he probably doesn't even read these, or it goes into some public mailbox, right? That
sure, right.
He has secretaries or someone look through and parse.
Yeah, typically it's an assistant. There's some assistants that will go through these historically and usually respond to people via email. But this is where this story kind of takes a turn, right? There's a twist.
Yeah. Here. So I go about my day again.
Why we're talking, because I've never heard of this before. But so what happened?
So I'm at work the next day, and around 11 a.m., I get this phone call, and I look, and it's from a California number. And I'm thinking it's AppleCare calling me to let me know that they found my phone or something.
Right.
So I pick it up, and the person on the other end says, "Hi, is Mr. Goodman available?" I said, "Yeah, this is him." And he says, "Yeah, this is Tim Cook from Apple. I just wanted to speak with you a few minutes about your email. Do you have time?" And I can't talk right now at this point that, you know, Tim is on the line. And
did you, once he said that, was his voice instantly recognizable to you? I mean, he kind of has a distinct accent and cadence and presence, or were you still just thrown off
after,
a bit?
I was thrown, because I wasn't expecting it.
Sure.
So I just thought it was a guy. But once he said Tim Cook, I'm like, oh, that is him.
Okay, cool.
And, he just asked basically me to go over the email again and just tell him kind of in finer detail, which is easier to do over voice.
Right.
And the call lasted about 2 minutes, and then he ended it with, "Don't worry, we'll get this resolved and have a good day," and that kind of thing. I'm like, all right. About 10 minutes after that, I get another phone call from a California number, and it's his executive relations department.
Right.
So they've now taken over my case. They've canceled everything with AppleCare and basically said, "You'll have a new phone by tomorrow." So, okay. I really didn't think it'd turn around that quickly. But sure enough, 24 hours later, there was a brand new iPhone 10 that was delivered to my house. So it was kind of a cool story.
Yeah, it's a very cool story. And that's what you tweeted me about. And I even, you know, when I first got it, you know, because I texted you or tweeted you back, and I'm like, are you sure it wasn't just, you know, his office calling you? Like, this was really the guy. So that's really unusual. I wanted to talk to you about it, and I appreciate you sharing the story, because this is the first time I've ever heard of someone actually getting a call from Tim Cook. I'm assuming it's happened before, but I've just never personally heard it. You know, I do know that he does occasionally read some of those emails. So yes, it all does go into sort of, I think they have probably some sort of managed inbox that I think his executive assistants or the executive team probably that you talked to second or dealt with you second deals with. And then I think he probably still has access. I mean, Steve Jobs was also pretty well known for doing that, where he would pick up an email and he would usually email respond to somebody. And I think Tim has email responded to folks before in the past that I'm aware of. But this is the first time I've ever heard of a phone call. So that's really cool, man.
Yeah,
I'm glad that Apple ultimately took care of you. How much of it do you think was, you know, how you crafted the email specifically and getting your resolution? Because this is something that I talk to people about a lot, is, you know, you can be firm, but also be polite. I think it's really easy to want to just like rant, right?
Right. I think it was 100% the way I crafted the email. So, you know, I started it out saying, basically, I've been an Apple customer since I was in elementary school, right? Using Apple computers, and then eventually iPods and phones and that kind of thing. And then I did say, this is why I choose Apple, is for the customer service. And unfortunately, it let me down this time. Now let me tell you why. You know, this is what I expected, and this is what I experienced. And, you know, just say facts and try to leave emotion out of it.
And so was that what he was really asking you about? I mean, was that what kind of things he wanted more details on, or he just kind of wanted you to go over the email?
He kind of wanted more details just about, you know, why I was disappointed in the points at which they could have done better to fix it.
That's
you
really
know,
cool.
Like what my expectation would have been versus what I saw or what my past experience has been versus right. what this one was.
That's awesome. I mean, that kind of shows to me that at a very high level, Apple is paying a little bit more attention to some of this customer service stuff, some of this quality of service stuff that I think, I don't know what your experience has been over the past couple of years, but we've talked about it here on the MacCast is that sometimes it feels like it had been going down for a while. You know, mm-hmm. I think up to the point where maybe they did the whole Mac Pro thing. Mm-hmm. But my last few experiences it seems to me like it's turning around a little bit too. Like things got a little worse, but I think they're getting better. And I have to imagine that it's little interactions like this that make the difference.
I think so too. And then this only like falls down the organization as well, right? And if like people start hearing this story, they're like, oh wow, you know, the CEO of this $1 trillion company is going to step out and help people. You know, what else can we do at the lower levels to help as well?
Yeah, that's really, really cool. Well, thanks for sharing your story with us, Tanner. I appreciate it and appreciate you reaching out to me on Twitter. Before we leave, I know you do some stuff occasionally online. Is there any place you want to like tell people about or maybe follow you on social media, something like that?
Yeah, so you can follow me on Twitter at Salem_AOA. And I just started a new podcast a few weeks ago called Just Google It. And it's basically a podcast where I find something that I don't know a whole lot about and I Google it for a few hours and then report back in audio form to the listener. And the second episode of that should be out sometime this week, I believe, on Friday.
All right. And I'm assuming people can find that on their favorite podcast app.
Yeah, so it's everywhere but Stitcher, as far as I know. So if you just search Just Google It, it should pop up.
Just Google It in Google.
That's right. Google it. Just Google it.
That sounds like some, you might end up in some weird Inception kind of moment, but hopefully they can find you. All right, man. Thanks, Tanner. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
So there you go. Pretty amazing story. Phone call from the man himself. This is, as I stated in that segment, this is one of the first cases I've personally heard of a person being called directly by Tim Cook. Now, over the years, we've heard of rumors, or I have heard of rumors, I guess I should say, of him calling customers. And we do have confirmed times for, like, you know, somebody was saved by their Apple Watch and they got a call from Tim Cook, or, you know, you're the current sitting president of the United States and you get a call from Tim Cook. But this is the first time I've really heard of customers getting called. Now, I did try to confirm this as much as I could. I mean, there was really no way for me to confirm this. And like I said, I was skeptical at first. If this had not been somebody that I knew personally and a friend that I trust, I don't know that I necessarily would have shared this with you here on the MacCast, but, you know, I trust Tanner, on this. And at the end of the day, though, I do have to point out that, you know, there's no way for me to absolutely vet this. I can't call up Tim Cook and ask him if he did this. Apple's PR team, as much as I email them, they don't get back to me. And on something like this, they're not going to respond. Maybe they'll respond after hearing this. I don't know. Maybe we'll get latter confirmation of this. I did ask around and heard through my grapevine that folks at the Genius Bar have been told by customers who have reached out to Tim Cook's office that they received phone calls. So I have more hearsay information, but nothing concrete or nothing confirmed. But it's super fun to think that if you do email Tim Cook about something, you might get a few precious moments of his time. I can't imagine that he does this very frequently or very often. But as I stated in there, it's fun to imagine. And even if it never really happens or doesn't happen for you, the myth of it is a fun thing to think about. I would relish a phone call from Tim Cook, just a few minutes to actually talk to him and just thank him for all of the things that Apple has done and all of the ways they have impacted my life personally, including creating this podcast, which is a great thing. But thanks to Tanner for taking his time to share that story with us. And I'm going to throw it to the community. Do you know somebody who actually got a call from Tim Cook or maybe even Steve Jobs or any higher up at Apple and actually had a chance to talk with somebody about this stuff? And I mean outside of maybe just having a business relationship. You know, I know there's people that have working relationships with Apple vendors and third-party people that have been in meetings with these guys, and I know a lot of stories surrounded that. I'm talking about if you're a customer and have been personally contacted by them, let me know about it. I'd love to kind of confirm if this was something that Apple does commonly at the executive level. Again, it's great to think about because I think Apple does care that much about it, and I think they do want to know from customers directly on occasion, you know, what their experiences are like. And I think they use that information to, as Tanner put in that piece, trickle down through the rest of the organization. So I want to believe that this is a thing that happens frequently, but I just can't totally confirm it other than, you know, I have a trusted friend who told me it happened. So I do believe it. So there you go. Siri, let's talk about Siri. And some of you might be groaning. Yep, Apple, Adam is a huge Siri fan. And I am. I love Siri. I use it each and every day. I use it more and more for various things. But as you know, and we've talked about here on the MacCast in the past, Siri can take a lot of flack, especially when being compared against other people's favorite digital assistants. But recently, I think there's a lot of agreement in our community and with a lot of the people that I talk to about Siri who maybe have experienced frustrations with Siri in the past, that things do seem to be getting a lot better, that Siri seems to be getting smarter, Siri seems to be getting more intelligent about handling things. Siri's getting more features. We know that Siri is going to have some limited third-party support coming in iOS 12 that I'm super excited about. And I mentioned recently, I think maybe even in the last MacCast, that there was a kind of shootout of AIs that's being consistently done by a research firm, and that Siri is starting to hold her own against the likes of Alexa and Google Assistant, and actually even improving and beating them out in some areas when it comes to information. And they had kind of broken down things into a bunch of different areas. If you want to hear all about that report, go back and listen to the prior episode of the MacCast. But here what we're talking about is some feedback that I got from Steve, who wrote in, and he wanted to share some of his recent experiences and thoughts as well. And he kind of broke down Siri into his own what he calls levels. And I want to talk about that a little bit and some of those experiences. And so actually a year ago, Stephen contacted me to express some of his frustrations with Siri and specifically Siri inside CarPlay. And this time he was writing me to say, yeah, I have noticed the improvements, especially when it comes to Siri in my car with CarPlay. He says he was recently driving around. He had a technophobic friend who he was giving a ride somewhere and was showing off Siri and CarPlay in his car. And he said he's happy to report, quote, it has improved orders of magnitude over that time. So in just a year, he's seeing massive improvements in Siri and CarPlay, especially in answering all kinds of questions specifically related to navigation, informational kinds of queries, and various commands for controlling, you know, the radio and podcasts and things that you might control inside the car, sending texts and all those sorts of things. And as he was relaying this stuff to me in email, he said he had an interesting thought on how to break down the various areas of Siri, how it functions, and where Apple might be working on or need to work on different improvements. And so he kind of broke it down into three levels. I think he added a fourth level in a follow-up email. But the first three levels he explained was, you know, the first level just being understanding, really parsing text, you know, understanding the language accurately, getting the actual words that you're saying and getting those accurate. And then level two, he kind of defines as interpreting what you said or what you intended by the command that you were giving. And then related to that, Siri coming up with an appropriate and accurate response. And then level three is responding not just with a response or getting that accurate, but with the appropriate level of detail and information, what Steve called data in search, right? So searching for the information wherever it might be, whether it be the cloud or on your device, something like that, and bringing back not just a simple answer, but the appropriate level of detail for the request and just handling that stuff well. And we noted that, you know, hey, all of this stuff is improving. At level one, with parsing text, you know, he was saying things are getting better, but Siri still needs to do a better job, especially when it comes to areas outside of the U.S. He specifically said large metropolises inside, you know, or large cities inside the U.S. But I think overall in the U.S. with most U.S. accents, maybe not heavy southern accents or region specific accents, but with most accents, I think Siri works pretty well in the U.S. But I continually and still continue to hear from many of you who are in other countries, specifically parts of Europe, who are saying that no, Siri still struggles. I think also in parts of Latin America, stuff like that, if you have thicker accents, Siri can tend to have a hard time parsing that and understanding the actual language, the words that you're saying. And I would totally agree with that. But I'll also go on to say that I don't think this is just necessarily a problem of not getting the correct words, because I think the words can be corrected with the level two information, that context information or understanding what's being asked. And you can impart or deduce a word that you might not be confident that you that the system parsed, you know, or the meaning of a specific word by bringing in that additional context. And I'm not entirely convinced that Siri has improved a lot in that area as well. You know, if you miss a word, if there's another word that sounds similar, I think given that context, you could correct that. And I am seeing some improvements there, especially with dictation. I don't know if you do a lot of dictating using quote unquote Siri. I'm not sure that Siri is technically part of dictation, but a lot of people refer to it that way. But I have noticed that it will parse the text really quickly. And then I think it's doing processing in the background and maybe bringing in some of that context, and it will correct the text a lot of times before it completely finishes processing it. And that's the sort of thing that I'm talking about. And I think that's where we get to kind of this level two sort of thing. And the other thing at the level one, just parsing text that Steve pointed out, was that he has found and thinks that the quality of the microphones that are being used really impacts and plays a factor on that. And I totally would agree with you there, Steve. And specifically when it comes to CarPlay, I think a big problem for Apple is a lot of times they're using not the mic that is on the iPhone. This is my guess or what it feels like to me. I could be totally incorrect. And if you happen to know from a technical level that this is wrong, I couldn't find any confirmation of this. Please send me an email and correct me. But what it seems like to me is that, especially in cars, it's still trying to go through the car's audio system, which has its own microphones. And those microphones, depending upon the make and model of your car, may not be that great. And so I have found the one time that I've been able to use CarPlay that, you know, that impacts the experience. Also, I use an Anker Bluetooth system with a mic in my own car personally, and I think Siri struggles to parse my text accurately, and I think that's because of the quality of the Anker microphone. Frankly, it's a cheap adapter. It's got a cheap microphone in it. So it'd be interesting to see if technology-wise, Apple could, you know, bypass that if it's having a hard time parsing that text and just switch over to the built-in microphones. But I definitely think microphone quality plays a factor at this level one, as Steve has put it. Now, at level two, Siri, I think, tends to excel in not always forcing you to use specific phrasing. You can ask a lot of different questions in various ways, and Siri seems to handle those various requests all with the same results. So it doesn't really matter kind of how you say things, and that comes down to more understanding how humans speak. And in a lot of the other tests and studies that come up, this is pointed out quite frequently, that Siri tends to not force you into exact phrasing, whereas some of the other platforms and systems seem to do that for the most part. And Steve noted that and pointed it out too. He also mentioned that he felt that Siri hasn't done a great job in handling what I call follow-on questions. So you ask one question and Siri gives you the response, and then you want to ask something related, maybe not giving all of the original information. So an example that Steve gave me in his email was, who was the first president of the United States, which Siri can answer correctly, and then asking the follow-on question, and when did he die? And I actually tested this both with my HomePod and my iPhone, and for me it worked, but Steve said in his tests over in the UK, it didn't work. So I don't know if there's maybe some country variances to how Siri works as well. There very well could be, and maybe because you're asking US knowledge versus UK knowledge and it's regionalized, I don't really know. But this definitely did work for me, and I have found overall Siri seems to be vastly improving on handling these more conversational follow-on questions. She's always been able to handle a few of them, but it's getting better and better all the time. Where I feel there has still been a deficiency and kind of failure at this level two, sort of understanding and parsing text, is with what I was talking about a little bit earlier, the artificial intelligence inside Siri using actual contextual factors and additional information that it might have access to better handle your request and determine the intent of your request and factor, you know, those outside sort of influences into how it parses and chooses to understand and handle that request. And I'll give you a really specific example that I have frequently with my HomePod and Apple Music now. Apple has these really great playlists in Apple Music called Inspired By, and it's usually inspired by some artist. And so it's all music that other artists produce inspired by this original artist. And so, for example, I might say, play Inspired By the Cars, meaning I want the playlist, the Inspired By the Cars playlist, and that's the thing I want you to play. It's an Apple Music playlist. And what I will typically get as a response from Siri is, oh, I'm sorry, I can't find the song Inspired. And I get that, because if you say play Inspired By the Cars, it sounds like you're asking for the song Inspired By the Artist The Cars. Totally makes sense, and I get why Siri would respond that way. But here's where that context and using additional factors, I think, needs to come into play, right? I'm obviously asking about music. And so music would probably technically have a hierarchy, right? Siri should be able to deduce a little bit that, oh, I didn't find this track called Inspired, but maybe there's something else that you're asking for that's music related. So yeah, look for the song Inspired By that artist, but hey, you don't find it? What about maybe an album by that artist? Nope, I didn't find the album, or I didn't find anything that accurately seems correct. Hey, maybe there's a playlist that's called that, right? It could intelligently deduce and figure that out. And Siri hasn't gotten really great at handling those requests. Another thing that factors into this is maybe like geographic things, other small things like I'm requesting some movie-related information. Maybe geographically, based on the GPS, I'm standing right next to a movie theater. It's more likely that I'm wanting maybe movie times or information specifically about a movie that's playing at that theater than general movie information or showtimes from a theater that is in a completely other state or other country from where I'm at, which is an experience that sometimes people have with Siri. Siri should be smarter, again, about using access to the information. The artificial intelligence should use the information that it has access to immediately to kind of, especially for requests, because I know and I've read many articles that talk about the fact that the artificial intelligence will parse a request and then kind of give it a score as to, I'm pretty confident this is what you're asking for, or I'm mildly confident that this is what you're asking for, or I'm not so confident that this is what you're asking for. And I think in those last two scenarios where it's a little less sure, hey, now how about if we pull in some additional information, some additional data, and maybe try and infer and figure out and intelligently handle, more intelligently handle that request. And I think that makes it, you know, a little bit better. They also could be, I think, a little bit more conversational when things are ambiguous, right? So if I'm parsing your request and I'm not really confident this is the thing that you're asking for, why not just ask for some confirmation or ask for some clarity? I'm not absolutely sure. So in the case of the play Inspired By the Cars thing, doesn't find the thing. Hey, I didn't find the track inspired by the Cars. Were you maybe looking for a playlist? And then you say yes, and then it can narrow its own results to just looking for playlists that might fit that search term, right? Nothing wrong with that. And she does do that sometimes, I'm noticing now, but I think more frequently having that happen would be a good thing at sort of this level. And then the last level Stephen kind of brought up with this was this level 3, data and searching. I think for Siri, likely here, the biggest challenge is that Apple only wants to use their data, and in many cases, only the data that it has on the device. And accessing third-party or outside data, that requires licensing, that it requires getting access to that information. And also, because of Apple's strict privacy, you know, sort of rules and stuff like that, there's a lot of vendors that don't want to play with Apple. They're like, hey, if you're not going to give us information about your customers, then we're not going to license this data for you. So they struggle a little bit there. And Steve mentions being surprised that Siri doesn't have Formula One racing results and what he calls fixtures. I'm not down on that term, Steve, so I'm not really sure what that means. But point is, it doesn't have the data. And, you know, I think that's because they have to license that data from someone. I think for sports data, a lot of it comes from Yahoo Sports. Yeah, they could go out and kind of scrape that information from the internet, but there are legal issues with that, especially for a company like Apple. You can't just scrape data from Google and then use it, and that data is coming from some other source that you would potentially want to be licensed, and you know Apple could get in trouble for that. So they can't just do that and scrape the data. Parsing that gets really tricky and odd, and it tends to not be very accurate, and I think Apple wants a better experience than that. Steve did mention that the F1 data actually is coming as part of iOS 12, as part of the iOS 12 update. So Apple's constantly adding to its sports data and broadening the knowledge that Siri has. And, you know, they want to continue to work on that. And I think part of that also is coming in iOS 12, them opening up the platform a little bit. And Steve mentions in his email, he's excited about that. I'm excited about that too. You know, opening up, at least in a small way, to third-party apps and their data sources could help. But again, there's a quality control issue there and a data privacy issue at play that Apple's having to balance, right? And so they're doing it in a very controlled way and making sure that those data sources and what's happening there doesn't degrade the overall Siri experience. Because at the end of the day, you feel like you're interacting with Siri, not this third-party data. And if things are going wrong, you're not necessarily going to reach out and blame the third-party app or the third-party data source. You're going to be blaming Siri. And this is a little bit of the dilemma that Apple's gotten into with Apple Maps, right? They rely on third-party sources, and they don't have a lot of control of over those. They can influence them a little bit, obviously, because they're a big customer. But it takes longer to do fixes and changes and updates. And so more and more Apple wants to be in control of their own destiny and overall for privacy issues and concerns. They want a lot of this processing to happen on phone. But I think there is still a lot of opportunity for that to improve as well. And luckily, Siri shortcuts, I think some of this is going to be opened up a little bit, especially at that command level, and Siri will get a lot better on these things. And so overall, I'm very excited about the progress Siri's been making. I'm very excited to see what's happening with iOS 12. And I agree, Stephen. I think things are vastly quickly improving. I don't buy the arguments that Siri is super far behind the other platforms like Amazon and Google. I think all of the platforms are advancing very quickly and very well. I think there's a lot of amazing artificial intelligence and smart assistants stuff going on across all the platforms. I think in some areas, some are better than others, as they always are. And I think Siri has some huge benefits and advantages even over the other platforms. And I expect things to ramp up and improve at an even more rapid rate. And I think, again, it's happening across all the platforms. They're all pushing each other. They're all driving each other. And I think ultimately that's good for Apple and Siri. And I think we're seeing the benefits right now. And I think it's only going to continue to improve very, very quickly. So I know I personally use Siri and my digital assistants a lot more and a lot more frequently because they're getting better. And, you know, I think the whole back and forth of that is going to continue. So I'm super excited about it, as you might be able to tell. I'd love to know your thoughts and opinions on this. How much do you use Siri? Are you using other platforms and find those better? As always, you can share your comments and your emails with me, maccast@gmail.com. Okay, last thing for today's episode, to round it out, I have a thing of the moment for you, something that I ran across just a couple days ago. I haven't had a ton of time to play around with this, but on first impressions, I'm super excited about it. It is a podcast app called Breaker. I will have a link to it in the show notes at mattcast.com, but it's breaker.audio. And if you actually want to go to my profile page, you can go to breaker.audio/you/mattcast. So like you for user slash mattcast. And you'll see the podcast that I subscribe to. And you will also see podcasts that I actually guest starred on. Because what the unique thing about Breaker, the podcast app versus other podcast apps out there that you might install on iOS, is it's being billed as the social podcast app. And something that's always frustrated me with podcasting is, how do I find other podcasts? It's usually through friends or people I know, but that stuff doesn't get shared very much unless you see somebody in person and ask them, hey, what podcasts are you listening to? There's not a lot of like social sharing going on. And also, as a content creator, just getting feedback around episodes and having a place where people can comment on episodes and talk about things. Yeah, you have your website, but a lot of people don't go there. Occasionally people throw things on Twitter. Having some sort of consolidated place for those interactions to happen just doesn't exist for podcasts. And this podcast app is trying to do something about that. And I think it's really, really cool. Plus, it has a really great design, a cool, simple, clean interface. And it looks great, which I really, really appreciate. So it has the ability, of course, to subscribe and download to podcasts. It has a great feature where you can import them from other podcast apps that you already have installed on your device. So it makes switching over really easy. You're able to import and export an OPML file of all your feeds if you're old school like me and know how to do that. So there's a lot of ways to get your podcasts in there. As far as playback goes, it has all of the basic features that you'd want: skip forward, skip back, playback control speeds, the ability to skip silent moments. There's a sleep timer. So all of those features are there. You can manage and download new episodes. Your new episodes in this one download to a single playlist that you can control the sort order, both manually, newest to oldest, oldest to newest. So again, a lot of the basic features that you would expect to be inside any podcast app. One thing that I really like in here is, you know, there's a few podcasts that I listen to less frequently, and I prefer just to download episodes manually rather than have new episodes downloaded automatically. So there is what they call a mute feature. So you can mute a show, and those won't automatically get added to your playlist, but you can add them manually, just the episodes that you may want to catch from time to time. And it does have a control for the amount of storage total that your podcast can use, but it doesn't have like Apple Podcasts where you can say, hey, I want, you know, only the latest episode of this podcast, but I want all of the episodes of that podcast. It doesn't get that granular yet. And I kind of actually appreciate and like that simplicity, but that may, you know, put a few people off. I'm sure they're working on new features all the time, so I bet they have a list. Just not everything is in there. One feature, unfortunately for me and maybe for some Mattcast listeners, that you might miss if you use this app is support for podcast chapters. That does not appear to be in there. Hopefully they will add that in at some point. Of course, I'm going to be sending them feedback to put chapter support in there, but that's not there at the moment. But again, the big feature and the thing that I think makes this podcast app really cool is the social aspects of it. It is what makes a difference. And so what you can do is you can follow other Breaker users. I think I keep calling it Beaker. It's Breaker, B-R-E-A-K-E-R. So not the Muppet. Don't confuse that. And I'm sorry if I said that earlier. The social aspect. So you can follow other Breaker users. You can see what they listen to, what they like. You can share episodes that you like with other users that you follow on Breaker, and those will get added to their playlist. Of course, you can remove those from your playlist if you don't want to listen to them. You can favorite episodes, which if you do end up using this app and you subscribe to the Mattcast, please favorite the episodes that you really like, because that will help surface them inside the Breaker app. And something I'd like you to do as well is comment on apps. You can comment, and what's really cool about the comments is they can be attached to specific time points. And when you go into the app and you look at the comments, there's actually, you can click and you can start the audio right from that that time point. So you can actually get the context of the comment to the audio, which is really pretty cool. All these features are really cool, and I think help sharing the experience of podcasts a lot better, right? You can do this right inside the app. Of course, you have to use the app, but if there's a big enough community in there, I think it works out really, really well. And as I was playing around and looking at features, I found a few bugs, and this is really cool. And I think other apps have this because I think it's an application API that developers can build into their app, but I had never experienced it before. I took a screenshot because I was going to attach that to an email to send to their email support. Right inside the app, it recognized, hey, you're taking a screenshot. Is there some feature or bug you want to let us know about? And it asks you, and you hit OK, and it gives you the ability to mark up your screenshot and then file a bug report or a feature request right from inside the app. Didn't have to do anything else. And that was really, really cool. So I'm really liking this podcast app. I think it's been out for about a year or so. They just added a new feature for podcasters where they're going to give you the ability to actually directly sell individual episodes inside the Breaker app as well and maybe earn a little bit of revenue. So that's pretty cool. I might look into that at some point. Maybe we can do some special episodes that are pay for episodes, much in the vein of what I was talking about earlier, where trying to diversify your revenue stream for supporting your content that you're creating. So they're doing some cool things for podcasters, and I love seeing that. So check out this podcast app, Breaker.audio. And then I also have a little bit of an honorable mention for you. Another great podcast app, if you're looking for podcast apps, is Castro. I'm a huge fan of Castro. It's one of my favorite apps. If you do like podcasts with chapters, like the MacCast, it handles chapters, I think, better than any other podcast app out on the market. Maybe Downcast is at a level pretty close to Castro, but I kind of like the Castro interface and how they handle podcast chapters. But they released a new update to their Castro Plus version, which is the in-app yearly subscription version. So you can use Castro for free, a lot of the basic features, but they have some advanced features that if you're a paid subscriber of the app that you get. And they added this really cool new feature to the Plus version that lets you do chapter pre-selection on your podcasts. So what that means is if your podcast is available with chapters like the MacCast, you can see the chapter list for an episode, and then you can just check on or off the chapters that you want. So you check on the chapters that you want to hear, and any that you want to skip, you just uncheck. And then when you play the episode, it will only play the chapters that you've checked off. And that is really cool, especially if you're kind of short on time. Maybe you don't have time to listen to the whole podcast. You can just mark off the topics or the chapters that you specifically know that you want to get to and just skip the other stuff, come back to it later, or not at all. Doesn't really matter. They let you totally do that. So I think this is an amazing feature. I'm surprised no one has done this before. I think part of the problem is there's not a lot of us out there that do chapterized podcasts, but there are a few, and I know more Mac podcasts do chapters than maybe other podcasts. So that is my honorable mention, Castro, and you can find that in the App Store, and I will also have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsors, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, if you have a comment, a question for me, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, maybe you need some help with your Mac or your iOS device, I am ready and willing to help you. Just shoot me an email or an audio comment to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in and leave a voicemail on the listener hotline, that phone number, 281-622-4965. 4269-281-MAC-IM-9, and you can leave voicemail there. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, you can check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. That's another great place to ask questions and get help from the community. Or, of course, you can shoot me a question or a comment or, you know, just a message on social media. You can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, on Facebook, facebook.com/TheMacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Google Plus community at google.com/PlusMacCast. So that's all the places you can reach me. Plenty of ways to get in touch. That is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.